Brent is the founder and CEO of Taking Point Leadership, a progressive leadership and management consulting firm with a focus on business transformation and building high-performance cultures. A Dallas native, Brent holds a degree in finance with a minor in economics from SMU, certificates in English and history from Oxford University in England, and a graduate business degree from the University of San Diego. He is the best-selling author of Taking Point, a Navy SEAL's 10 fail-safe principles for leading through change, which was a number one new release on Amazon in organizational change and business structural adjustment. Ladies and gentlemen, please help me welcome Brent Gleason.
Thank you for that kind introduction. Thank you, World Affairs Council. How's everybody doing this afternoon? Let's get something straight right now, people. I may not be your typical World Affairs Council speaker. We'll have a hotel staff come on in here. We'll remove the tables and chairs. We'll just do burpees and push-ups until morale improves. How does that sound? This guy is excited about this. Let's try that one more time. How's everybody doing this afternoon? Fired up, engaged, ready to be entertained, maybe learn a little bit while we're on that journey. Well, thank you guys so much for having me. It's truly an honor and pleasure to be here with all of you this afternoon. So when a SEAL platoon is on patrol in enemy territory or sneaking into an enemy compound, the person in front is the point man. They're taking point. They're leading their team into what we call VUCA environments. And yes, that's one of the many hundreds, if not possibly thousands, of acronyms we live by in the United States military. It refers to the volatile, uncertain, complex, and ambiguous environments that we operate in. Sounds like the world of modern business, doesn't it? And rightfully so, that acronym is now widely used in the global business community, of course referring to the fast-paced, disruptive, volatile, an unsettled global business landscape that all organizations across all industries are a part of today in this modern age. And all this disruption, change, necessary speed of execution forces us as organizational leaders and managers, regardless of where we fall in the rank and file, to improve strategy, structure, organizational culture, improve our ability to lead and navigate change and organizational transformation. And just think about all the changes so many organizations have faced over the past 10 years alone. Economic disaster, changes in fiscal policy, radical changes in the political environment, digital transformation, technological advancements. And all this change and disruption, is that a threat to our organizations, our sustainability and growth? Or must we as leaders look at it as an opportunity to be taken advantage of? According to the 2018 KPMG CEO Outlook Report, 68% of CEOs across all organizations now see disruption and change both in their industries and in their organizations as an opportunity on their SWOT analysis, so to speak, as opposed to a threat. The data did not used to reflect that. And 75% of CEOs and senior executives claim they'll be investing more time, energy, and resources into improving and transforming their organization's culture and their levels of employee engagement to increase their growth trajectory, their competitive advantage, and their ability to navigate change and organizational transformation. So naturally, I can draw a simple military correlation here. We all knew that was coming at some point, right? Another great organization that has stood the test of time, overcome a lot of change, disruption, and adversity over the past 18 years, Naval Special Warfare, home to the United States Navy SEAL teams, widely known to be one of the most elite and feared special operations fighting forces in the entire world. Yet how have we continued to evolve, to adapt, to transform, to think more creatively about our battlefield, to sustain this fight and defeat a very dangerous and decentralized enemy? In large part, and this is the focus of the theme today, it's due to the mindset and behaviors of everybody in the organization and our very well-defined and distinct organizational culture, the culture based on the principles of leadership at all levels. So leadership as a behavior, as a mindset, regardless of rank, title, or tenure. Extremely high levels of trust and accountability woven into the fabric of that culture. Adaptability, We too lean into change and disruption and use it to our competitive advantage, resilience, and a relentless never-quit attitude. The secret to our organizational success is that our mindset, behaviors, and culture perfectly match our strategic vision and desired result, which is to win. And it's that winning leadership mindset that's so critical for leading change in any organization. It always reminds me of a great quote by Martin Luther King Jr. that says, "If you can't fly, you run. If you can't run, you walk. If you can't walk, you crawl. But no matter what, you keep moving forward." In the SEAL teams, we have an ethos, a creed that embodies our culture, our core values. A similar line from that ethos states, "I will not quit. I persevere and thrive in adversity. And if knocked down, I will get back up every time. I am never out of the fight." And it's that mindset, that behavioral norm, so critical for leading change. And so each and every one of you, all of us, can continue to take point as our roles and leaders in organizations, and what it means for each and every one of us in our work, in our lives, as we say in the SEAL teams, to be all in all the time. And being all in all the time is a philosophy we hold dear in the Naval Special Warfare community. And simply put, it embodies our expected level of participation within the organization. There's no other way of thinking, no other way of behaving, other than being all in every day, all the time. Well, I'm about to age myself, be careful. It was way back in late 1999 when I first made my decision to be all in. As it sometimes happens in a fit of youthful exuberance and foolishness, I left my job at Trammell Crow Company, joined the United States Navy with a lofty dream of serving as a United States Navy SEAL, a decision that would forever change my life and set me on the path that I'm on today. So this afternoon, I would like to share a brief history of that journey, share some stories and anecdotes from training, from the battlefield, so to speak. But much more importantly, we're going to talk about the disciplines, the mindsets, the frameworks and mechanisms and cultural pillars that forge our high-performance team environment in the special operations community. Now, we can all take these disciplines, frameworks, and cultural pillars and implement in our own organizations the disciplines of leadership at every level, better defining and managing organizational culture, and more importantly, aligning that culture and those behaviors with desired results, how to measure and improve accountability and trust as part of that culture, and bringing all these elements together to navigate change and achieve winning results as an organization. And hopefully give you guys some key takeaways, maybe some actionable insights, God willing, maybe even a little bit of inspiration you can apply to your own lives, both professionally and even personally. So let's dive in, shall we? All right, Mom, lead everybody in push-ups right now. Everybody down on the floor. Let's dive in, shall we?
Yes.
We need to take it up a notch in here, people. Now, as a bit of background, as you know now, I did grow up in the great nation of Texas. Can I get an applause for Texas, please? Now, every now and then that backfires, not one damn Texan in the whole room. Then I have to pity the entire audience. Little fun fact for you guys, about one-third of all active SEALs at any given time are from where? You're damn right. I know many of you come from data-driven organizations. That's not, no need to go fact-check that data, but let's just believe it to be true. Let's just go with it, all right? It makes sense. After SMU and a brief stint at Trammell Crow Company, I left that job, and one of my fraternity brothers from SMU, with whom I'd actually already been training, moved to a little town called Crested Butte, Colorado, where we trained for an additional couple months at upwards of 10,000 feet altitude for about 5 hours a day to get into the best physical condition that we could. And then in early 2000, mid-2000, joined the Navy after a few months of basic training. So on a plane headed out to sunny San Diego, California, where we would begin our journey. And I can tell you all with exact certainty and clarity, like it was yesterday, that I have never been more nervous in my entire life than the day I stepped foot into the lobby, or the quarterdeck for you Navy folks in the room, into the lobby of the Naval Special Warfare Training Center. Because it's a very scary and depressing thing, my friends, knowing for a fact, that your life is gonna be pure hell and misery for many months to come. But But of course, there was no turning back. I had to be all in. Another little fun fact for you guys, since we're talking business, let's put our human resources hats on here, talk a little bit about talent acquisition, employee retention. It now takes upwards of 16 to 18 months and costs about $3.5 million to train and acquire one SEAL. That doesn't count the millions of dollars spent once you make it to a SEAL team command. That's our taxpayer dollars at work, so let's give ourselves another round of applause. I used to say your tax, but it's my taxpayer dollars now too. And we're the biggest divas in the United States military, so we get everything we need. That 18 months is broken into various segments. The first segment is 6 months long, called BUDS, stands for Basic Underwater Demolition SEAL. Many of you in the room have probably seen the SEAL movie Lone Survivor, unfortunately based on a true story. The opening scenes are actually from a Discovery Channel documentary from BUDS Class 234. We run 6 classes a year, so every couple months. I followed them in Class 235. I was present for all this filming, and this will give you guys just a teeny tiny taste of what the early weeks of BUDS are all about. Let's take a look. Doesn't that look fun? Does anybody feel like they missed their calling in life? BUDS has the highest attrition rate of any special operations training and selection program in the world. None of us are extraordinary, exceptional individuals. We're just common people with an uncommon desire to succeed. I graduated with BUDS Class 235. I was assigned to SEAL Team 5. And after 2 very busy kinetic deployments to Iraq, Africa, some time spent in some other places I can't mention, I decided to stick to my plan. I transitioned out to go to graduate school. A decision, of course, in a way that sometimes I always deeply regret. Doesn't matter how much time you spend in the teams, short time, long time, you always feel like you're leaving your brothers and sisters on the battlefield. So I continue to serve by being on the executive board of the Seal Family Foundation and mentoring young men and hopefully someday women into and through this program. Just say I'm 5 for 5, so I must take full credit for that. So I went to graduate school, and after graduate school, essentially became a serial entrepreneur. No, I don't mean unemployed. First two companies I started were essentially in the technology space, and while those companies were blessed with rapid growth, rapidly growing companies, and an even faster changing industries, comes a lot of growing pains, a lot of challenges and obstacles that I'd not yet faced, at least on the battlefield of business. I was faced with challenges as a young business leader, manager, entrepreneur, forcing to lead change and organizational transformation. I failed at it many times, eventually started to get it right. And it wasn't really until I started reflecting back onto the frameworks, the mechanisms, the expected behavioral norms, and the cultural principles, and started instilling those, taking those from the SEAL teams, the special operations community, and ingraining those into the framework and cultures of those organizations, that they started to mature, they started to evolve, they started to become more resilient, culture transformed, levels of employee engagement improved. Essentially, they became healthier organizations. So earlier we talked about how we're going to talk about the disciplines of leadership, defining and managing culture, aligning culture with desired business results, and understanding the implications on productivity and financial health of the cultural pillars of accountability and trust, and bringing all these elements together to achieve growth, navigate change, and achieve winning results as an organization. We can talk all day long about the different characteristics of leaders and what it takes not just to lead successfully in an organization, on a team. One of the hardest disciplines of leadership is leading through change, leading in VUCA environments. There's three critical leadership skills that leaders must master to successfully navigate organizational transformation. The first is the skill and ability to lead that change. Organizational change efforts fail so much, in large part because the leaders and managers do not have the skill set or experience to successfully navigate change. The second is to enlist the feedback and participation from as many people as possible in the organization. That accomplishes two things simultaneously. We as leaders and managers are gathering ground intelligence, critical for making informed decisions on what that transformation mission plan should look like. But more importantly, you're gaining buy-in because you're giving everybody in the organization a voice in what that mission plan should look like, and therefore you can celebrate successes and navigate the obstacles together as a team. And third, of course, is the art of being facilitative. Leading that organization through change, being able to course correct through uses of collaborative tools so the team continues to have a voice. Oftentimes we give them a voice, we use some of that data, and then we don't give them a voice throughout the journey, the change effort fails. But of all the different disciplines in leadership critical for leading change, the most important burden of command that's so often deprioritized is building, managing, and protecting a winning culture. In the SEAL teams, we train for war and we fight to win. Failure to execute our job functions on the battlefield in training is not an option. But it goes back to our rituals, our behaviors and actions that define our culture. The expected behavioral norms of discipline, accountability, trust, transparency, communication, and teamwork. Those forge our culture, and our culture aligns with our strategy and results, and therefore it's how we build winning teams that are much greater than the sum of their parts. The United States military entered these conflicts after 9/11, essentially as a large, slow-moving, overmanaged, underled, vertically and horizontally siloed 20th century organization. We were under the misconception that we were fighting the same organizational framework, which of course we now know we are not. We were fighting a very dangerous and decentralized enemy. So we quickly realized that to move at the speed these wars required, we had to redesign our organizations. New systems, new processes, new mechanisms, new frameworks, improving internal and external communication strategies, better sharing of information across silos and barriers. And eventually, that led to a mindset and culture transformation. The culture transformation in an organizational change effort happens towards the end, not the beginning, because behaviors and mindsets have to adopt the new way of doing things. Now, unfortunately, in a business setting, according to McKinsey & Company data, my own research, and other research out there, upwards of 70% of organizational transformation efforts either fail or fall significantly short of meeting their intended objectives, in large part due to the deprioritization of the cultural implications. The cultural implications are one of the most important aspects of leading successful change in an organization. According to the 2018 Deloitte Human Capital Trends Report, CEOs, senior executives, and HR professionals from all over the world, all different types of industries that were surveyed, cited the areas of organizational culture, employee engagement, and employee retention as what they defined as urgent. Basically, areas in their organizations that required immediate attention and investment of time and resources to improve their growth trajectory, their strategic advantages, and their ability to navigate change and organizational transformation. An interesting data point that came from that survey was that today's workforce, especially some of the younger generations, the millennials, I'm just gonna put it out there. It's a whole different presentation, people. Just kidding for the millennials in the room. No, but today's workforce, especially multi-generational workforces and the younger folks in the workforce, data shows that they care deeply about the mission, the values, the culture, the workplace environment, and the why, so the purpose behind the organizations they seek to join. And we all should, shouldn't we? But culture is reflective of leadership. And culture is what drives engagement, and culture engagement are what drives results in an organization, for better or worse. But here's some interesting data. As we all know, unemployment's at like an all-time low. Yet according to Global Gallup research from last year, employee disengagement, I'm pointing at you, Jordan. Will you just advance it? Employee disengagement is at an all-time high. Only 15% of people in most organizations can be defined as what we call engaged, meaning I'm emotionally connected to the mission narrative of the organization. I go above and beyond. I'm all in all the time. There we go. I got it. Basically, I'm a team player. I collaborate well across silos and barriers. I'm what I refer to in the book as a change evangelist. These are the people that you're going to lean on, at least initially, in a transformation effort to evangelize the vision for change throughout the organization. And then we have the bulk of the workforce in most organizations are what we call the disengaged. The challenge with the disengaged, and I've seen this in my own companies, organizations that my firm works with, is they're hard to identify. Oftentimes, relatively satisfied in their role, sometimes even happy, but the people who clock in, they clock out, they collect a paycheck, kind of do the bare minimum, not really team players, not emotionally connected to that mission narrative. They're what we refer to as the fence sitters during times of transformation. So they adopt a wait-and-see mentality. Sometimes they're jaded because they've seen transformation efforts fail in the past, or sometimes they just don't care. And then, of course, that leaves, if we do the quick math, we've all worked with these people, what we call the actively disengaged. Everybody's worked with one of these folks. These are the toxic jerks that create a cancerous environment in the organization, especially during times of change and transformation. They are your change anarchists. The problem with the actively disengaged, and we've all seen this before, is oftentimes they have a strong voice within the organization due to either tenure or subject matter expertise, or sometimes both. And therefore, that toxicity can spread more rapidly than another person in the organization. Herein lies not the problem, but the opportunity from a leadership and management standpoint. When we as leaders and managers in any organization, this applies in business, nonprofits, sports teams, family, we prioritize managing culture, aligning culture with strategy and results, and make employee engagement and culture part of the organization's strategy to achieve those desired results, that is the bedrock of the highest functioning organizations in the world. So it's great to talk about culture and creating a great workplace environment, but how do you really do this? How do you align culture? How do you align experiences, beliefs, and actions with the actual desired results an organization needs to achieve? We can further articulate and visualize this by what I refer to as the culture transformation results pyramid. At the top here, you have the existing results, and your organization has two types of results, the existing results and the desired results. The results the organization needs to achieve goals, fulfill vision, exit strategy, what have you. Next tier is the actions and standard operating procedures that everyone must take proactively to achieve those results. What are the beliefs and behaviors that we all, especially leaders and managers, must authentically embody to drive ourselves and others to take those actions? And then what are the rituals, what I refer to as cultural experiences, that instill those beliefs in an organization? So when you're going through any type of transformation, you have to go from here to here. Not just from the existing culture, because the actions, beliefs, and experiences define the culture, and the culture is what drives the results. So you need to start implementing new systems, new actions, new standard operating procedures, instilling new beliefs driven by new rituals and cultural experiences to achieve desired results. So, for example, in the military, in the special operations community, obviously one of our desired results is readiness, ready to go into battle in a moment's notice. My first tour to Iraq, we were the first task unit of 40 SEALs in about April 2003, deployed into Iraq to perform what we call capture or kill missions, essentially working with other government agencies to track down folks on the deck of cards, blacklist, other various insurgent faction leaders. We did upwards of about 100 combat missions inside a six-month period. So for you mathematicians in the room, that's a lot. So you can see why readiness is critically important. Sometimes we would do two or three missions in a night. So the cultural experience, the rituals we instilled to drive that belief that readiness was a number one priority is the higher in manarchy and timing in which we would prepare gear, weapons, comms equipment, vehicles, whatever, to make sure that we are ready to go out the door whenever needed. So it doesn't matter if you've been on a three-day sniper overwatch mission in the dangerous streets of Ramadi, a six-hour underwater combat dive at night, combat training scenario. As soon as you get back to base, you drop everything, you go into a room to perform an after-action review, leaving rank and motion at the door. Talk about what went right, what went wrong, how we're going to do it better. It's part of our constant feedback loop and learning culture. And then and only then are you going to go take a nap, get something to eat, call mom and dad back at home, or do whatever you need to do. It's a ritual that drives the belief that preparedness is a number one priority and comes before my own selfish desires. I remember one particular night where it was supposed to be a pretty simple two-hour door-to-door mission. It was an Al-Qaeda weapons cache and safe house in a rural area outside of Baghdad. Went in helos, humped in about one click. And I was point man of the squad that was peeling east towards one of the predetermined buildings that we were going to be taking down. Night vision goggles, looking super cool like this. And I was so fixated on the door that we were going to stack on and breach this building that I wasn't looking down, of course, looking through night vision goggles for a long time and then looking down below them. Messes with your eyes. I went forward and forward. And then I fell waist deep into a cesspool. Only a few minutes into this mission, and it was already a crappy situation. See what I did there? Unfortunately, it gets worse. We got intel from that target that led us to a second target. Intel from that target led us to a third target. What was supposed to be a two-hour mission was 20 hours in the field. Me, this guy, covered waist down in, well, what resides in a cesspool. No, it's not funny. It was really embarrassing. Nobody sat next to me in the Humvee. We got back to base. It's the only time that I broke this protocol, this framework that achieved desired results. We got back to base. Platoon dropped their gear. Went to the platoon hut for the after-action review. I made my way to the burn pit, removed my pants, socks, and boots, and tossed them in, reported to the after-action review meeting in body armor and underwear. This framework is not just how you align culture, behavior, and actions with desired results. It's how you achieve a true culture of accountability. Accountability is one of the two most important cultural pillars for high performance and leading an organization through change. One of my favorite lines from the SEAL ethos says, "In the absence of orders, I will take charge, lead my team, and accomplish our mission. I lead by example in all situations." So how do we apply this results pyramid, this philosophy of building a culture of accountability to a business organization? One of our firm's clients is a San Diego-based global healthcare company. And many years ago, under a different brand name, they were essentially a failing entity, known on Wall Street to be, you know, well-intentioned, but horrendous at execution. The most leveraged medical device company in the industry at the time, with $335 million in revenue and $550 million in debt. For you finance folks out there, that's not what your balance sheet should look like. They were essentially a failing entity, so the board brought in a new CEO, you know, a turnaround guy, except he was their fourth CEO in 5 years. So you can imagine the murmurings amongst the frontline troops. Here we go again, another attempt to save our sinking ship. Yet he brought with him a totally different mindset, a different way of approaching it. While he did assemble what I refer to as a transformation task force, essentially a cross-functional team to institute your traditional change management tactics and strategies, the catalyst to this new mindset was actually through a conversation with one of his VPs of marketing. They were walking back from a company barbecue one day, and she was like, "You know what, Dave, we've got some really go-to accountable people in research, development, some in manufacturing, some in sales. Now imagine if we could put some sort of system in place to replicate that behavior across the entire organization, how much positive change we could drive. Light bulb went off, long story short. After 2 years of him as the senior leader, driving what I refer to as a culture-driven transformation with a goal of achieving 100% accountability across the organization, their stock price went from 13 cents a share to $14 a share. Actually, this was over 2 years. They started growing at 15% a year, which was unheard of for an organization their size in that industry at the time. They reached a market cap of $15 million and sold to another healthcare giant for $2 billion. Essentially, this culture transformation drove a 7,000% return on an equity investment from the time they started to the time they sold the company, and they later spun off to be the healthcare giant they are today called CareFusion. Point being is that culture has such an important impact in driving a culture of accountability, has a measurable return on productivity, efficiency, and the profitability of any organization. Any animal lovers in the room? No? Wow, you people are evil. Oh, okay, good. There's some out there. Now, studies actually show that interacting with animals can actually improve human social interaction in the areas of trust and empathy, which is why I thought these pictures are appropriate for the trust section. As I said, I did spend a little time in Africa. That is a monkey on my head. His name was Iron Mike. I was on a long training run one day through the trails in Africa in the country we were in. Saw him on the side of the trail. Unfortunately, his mom had passed. So I thought it'd be a great idea to scoop this little guy up, rolled him up in my shirt, and ran him 5 miles back to camp. Then I got back to camp, and I was like, ah, damn it. Now I got to take care of this monkey. You all probably remember the four Americans that were killed in this cowardly suicide bombing in Syria. Ironically, I saw on the news today that we've caught 5 ISIS fighters that were part of that attack, trying to extradite them back to the United States. One of those Americans was Navy SEAL Scotty Wirtz, one of my best friends from SEAL Team 5. I mentioned that because he took this picture. So he and I co-parented this little guy for several months. I ended up doing all the work, of course. Now I know how my wife feels. You know, I made him a little karate outfit, transitioned him from milk to solid food, got him addicted to TV, which was my main goal. I still parent that way. Anybody else? No. He loved watching reruns of those adult cartoons like Simpsons and Family Guy. And I needed him to have an activity while I was out, you know, doing the nation's business. So how many people in here have children? Young children? Children that were once young? I don't know if your kids do this, but when I wasn't out operating, he would sleep in my rack with me, either nestled in my armpit or on my chest right here. So in the morning, he would climb up onto my chin. He would squat right here. With his front paws, he would grab my top eyelashes and rip my eyes open and scream in a high-pitched voice, "Hey, Dad, wake up, it's time to eat." And then he would proceed to urinate on my neck. I was not well-versed in potty training at the time. Got 3 kids now, much better at it. Our youngest just turned 3. He's almost there. Not quite yet, though. So he's the guy who walks around the house in a t-shirt, cowboy boots, and no pants. And yes, that is a dog attached to my friend's body. As he jumps out of the back of that plane, you know what that little guy's thinking right now? Man's best friend, my ass. Not a happy camper. When we think about the notion of trust in an organization, the internal trust we have for one another, the trust leadership has for the team has for leadership, external trust we build with customers, clients, shareholders, strategic partners, like accountability and culture, is trust a nice-to-have social variable, or does it drive the health, performance, and productivity of the greatest organizations in the world? Human Capital Institute performed a study called Building Trust, Workforce Trends Driving High Performance. And a key data point that came from that survey was that employees were working in what they defined as high-performing organizations, essentially companies that maintained steady growth trajectory, continuing to build shareholder value and whatnot. Those employees, as based on anonymous surveys, believe their leaders, their managers, and their peers to be highly trustworthy individuals. Everyone in the organization walks the walk, talks the talk, lives by the values of the organization on and off the battlefield, promises are fulfilled, appropriate levels of transparency exist as part of the culture. And the 2 areas trust affects most in any business organization are productivity and employee engagement. And since we already established that employee engagement can be a bit of a challenge, but also a great leadership opportunity, one might theorize that In some organizations out there, trust is either not valued, or more typically from what I've seen, it's simply not properly managed and measured as a part of the culture and strategy. More Gallup research from last year shows that employee disengagement here in the United States, that big part of the pie chart you saw earlier, oftentimes in organizations due to low levels of internal trust, lack of accountability, cultures that do not mesh well with the strategy and results, those high levels of disengagement cost us upwards of $550 billion a year in lost productivity. So I think we can conclude that the implications of leadership development and culture transformation, measuring and improving accountability and trust are not, in fact, soft side management strategies. They're not nice to have social variables, but they drive the health, productivity, efficiency, and profitability of the most well-run organizations out there. So in closing, I wanted to share a brief poem with you. I always like to end with something thought-provoking, inspirational. There's a poem widely shared in the Naval Special Warfare community. It really embodies our culture, how we approach life and work. And this poem was authored by a Chief Tecumseh. He was a Shawnee chief before, during, and after the War of 1812. He was a known warrior poet. And even though this poem is titled Death Song, I want you to listen to these words, because it's so much more a metaphor for life. Live your life. So the fear of death may never enter your heart. Trouble no one about their religion. Respect others in their views. Demand that they respect yours. Love your life. Perfect your life. Beautify all things in your life. Seek to make your life long and of service to your people. Prepare a noble death song for the day you go over the great divide. Show respect to all people, but grovel to none. When you rise in the morning, give thanks for the light, for your life, for your strength. If you see no reason for giving thanks, fault lies within yourself. When your time comes to die, be not like those whose hearts are filled with the fear of death. So they weep. They pray for a little more time to live their lives over again in a different way. Sing your death song and die like a hero going home. Now, if you listen to those words, it's not about death, is it? It's about life. Living our lives to the fullest extent, creating and seizing every opportunity we have to be better. Not better for our own selfish desires, better for the organizations we're a part of, the people we inspire, the teams we lead, our communities, families, bettering the lives of those around us, and hopefully one day making this world a little bit better place than we found it. So ladies and gentlemen, as you step forth onto your battlefield, leading change, pursuing excellence and innovation in everything you do, and achieving maximum performance, remember these three things, these three Navy SEAL sayings about resilience. Get comfortable being uncomfortable. Push the boundaries and confines of your comfort zone every chance you get. The more you do, the wider that area becomes. And in my experience, and I think you would agree, it's outside of our comfort zone where the magical opportunities truly present themselves. Next, remember that the only easy day was yesterday. There are no easy days for high-functioning individuals, for high-performance teams, pursuing an existence of excellence. Our lives, our work, are full of challenges. We simply have to face those challenges head-on, controlling what we can and ignoring what we can't. And lastly, my friends, I ask that you be all in, all the time. Ask yourself every day, at what level am I willing to participate on my team, my organization, my family, in this life? No matter what challenges life throws your way, whether they be personal, professional, or otherwise, not if, but when you get knocked down, get back up every time and never, ever be out of the fight. God bless you guys. Good luck in your journey. Thank you so much. Appreciate it. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Appreciate that, brother. Thank you.
We have time for about... We have time for about two questions, and then I want to be sure that you have time to visit with people and sign some books. And let me
And I can answer more questions, too, during the book signing.
And let me remind everyone, too, that the next program is part of Boardroom in the Texas Capitol Boardroom, Leadership in the Boardroom, will be April 23rd, I think, with Alan Stamm, who is the dean of the Batten School of Leadership, of course, at the University of Virginia. And at that time, we'll be celebrating, you know, the victory in the March Madness. Keith Cargill is here. Keith, I didn't see you earlier. Thanks for being here. Go ahead.
Yeah, thank you.
Questions and comments?
Questions. I know we had a couple planted. Good.
I guess. not planted, but whoops, I don't know if this will work.
It is.
I can hear you. Okay. I'm standing right here.
Had a commander in chief who's actually fought, who's actually been at war. How does the military and how do you see in business dealing with that disconnect?
Essentially, the way we deal with that disconnect, I'm assuming everybody heard the basis of the question, is to taking a more, and this is part of our transformation in the military, it's how businesses are transforming as well, is to go again from more of that top-down command and control environment that's very vertically siloed. So to your point, information, data, even important pieces of the strategy and purpose and vision get trapped in those vertical silos. So you go down, I mean, we've done this assessment in organizations before, you go down one layer and people are like, yeah, I kind of understand the vision, the strategy, what we're doing. You go down another level and people are like, I think so. They throw like a key phrase or a couple words at you, another layer, no idea what's going on. Bottom layer, the people who are executing on the front lines, absolutely no clue what's going on. So they're typically doing things the same way they've always done them because they don't really know any better. They're not connected to that vision. And it really goes into the decentralized controls that we're instituting in the special operations community and in the world of modern business. So we're not doing away with hierarchy and structure, but you're sort of overlaying ecosystems and networks that are more agile, have information sharing mechanisms that and better tools. So you might have a continued centralized decision-making process within an organization or within the military, but once you get further down, closer to the battlefield, so to speak, you're decentralizing those controls. And also in the military and in organizations, we're just doing a better job of utilizing technology and tools to share information, creating centers of excellence, better planning, better after-action reviews. So for example, one of the ways we continue to bring lessons back from the battlefield, which keeps information not just flowing down, but also back up so that we can continue to evolve our training investment, our strategy, whatever we're doing to the battlefield, is by, for example, when we perform an after-action review after a mission, all that data is documented, it's pushed out to all the other teams. So when you're at the office teams, half the time you're spending reading intel reports and after-action reviews. We apply that to lessons learned, apply that to our constant feedback loop and learning. So it creates a better downward information flow and upward information flow that helps to dissolve a lot of those silos that exist, not just in the military, but in most business organizations. And from what I've seen is silos, we can work diligently to actively break down silos by restructuring, creating more cross-functional teams. But what typically happens, and there's other research that shows this, is those silos organically rebuild themselves just in a different way. So silo destruction, as I refer to it, is sort of a constant leadership and management strategy that has to be a part of creating better vertical and horizontal communication mechanisms that so people can share information, you can be more agile utilizing that information. So, thank you. Yes, sir.
I'd like to explore the difference between the individual and the team. Some of the qualities that you mentioned, for example, a positive attitude, the ability to pick oneself up and go forward, facing adversity. Does a person have that in your experience in coming in, or is this something that they develop as being part of a successful team?
It's a great question. So we'll align that specifically with the special operations selection process. We can apply that to a business organization in a second. But essentially, so for example, we were talking about this at the table a little while ago, is the Naval Special Warfare community and special operations community in general. We've been investing millions and millions of dollars in market research to identify the answers to that question. who is the student who's more likely to graduate. So you think of it as a sales funnel. We need better leads in the top of the funnel so we can close more deals. Except we still graduate the same percentage almost every single class. It fluctuates, but the average is we're still graduating a very small percentage from each class. If you had to distill it, the three data points that we've distilled down to are polo players who like to, or so water polo players who like to play chess and hate authority. So that is your ideal Navy SEAL student who is going to, so if you guys know anybody, please let me know. I'm a recruiter, and anyways. But yes, those are three data points I heard recently, for especially from our tier one special operations selection process. But what we typically see, and we also see this, one way of articulating this is one of the accountability mechanisms we instill as one of our rituals and cultural experiences throughout every single week of that 18-month training pipeline is, anybody ever done anonymous 360 reviews before? Yeah, they suck, right? So, especially in the comments section, that's where they really get you. You're like, I know who said that, they're getting fired. So we perform what we call a much more brutal version of a weekly 360 review, anonymous, called the top five, bottom five. It's one of our rituals that instills accountability as part of our culture. So every Friday afternoon, you come into the class, and you sit down, a class instructors pass out a sheet of paper, five lines on the top, five lines on the bottom, areas for commentary, and you're instructed to anonymously rank who you believe the top five performers are in the class and who you believe the bottom five performers are in the class. I know what some of you are thinking, wow, what a great way to celebrate success and high achievement. No, they never tell you who the top five are, because people, that would be something called positive reinforcement. And we do not deal in positive reinforcement in SEAL training. What we do, however, is deal heavily in negative reinforcement. So what they do is they take all the names, this happens, all the names in the bottom five every Friday and post them right there on the whiteboard next to the door. It gets worse. With a check next to each name notating how many times that person by their peers was listed in the bottom five. It's not a super fantastic way to start your weekend, I can't imagine. I wouldn't know, just kidding. But my point is, the reason, and we've studied this obviously years and years and years of studying, the reason people are landing in the bottom five are not because they're not the fastest swimmer, the fastest runner, the best shooter in the kill house, or on the sniper range. It's what? Moral issues, ethical issues, attitude, lack of accountability, lack of trust. Essentially, a person you not want to be standing next to in a gunfight in Fallujah. It's those behavioral mechanisms, and those expected behavioral norms like I was talking about before, and this is one of those rituals that we do to not just instill that belief that accountability, peer-to-peer accountability and peer-to-peer trust are paramount in a high-performance team environment, but anything other than that will absolutely not be tolerated. So that's one of the ways that we start to weed out those folks that aren't going to embody those types of core values and behavioral norms. And then on the other side, I always get the question, kind of related to what you're saying, is, you know, grit, resilience, do you have it, do you not have it? I believe, of course, that's something like any other behavior, that something that can be learned. Some people maybe are a little bit more resilient than others, but resilience, and I'm writing a whole new book about resilience and personal transformation right now. It's called Embrace the Suck, so pick it up in a year. It is. And it's really something, there's mechanisms in the book to show how we can use these little micro steps to improve grit and resilience by creating our own sort of post-mortem after action review process. And when things go right, when things go wrong, we're bouncing back from adversity. So it's something that you can step-by-step build over time. And you do definitely, if you don't have grit and resilience in SEAL training, you're definitely gonna get it, unless you're washed out. So thank you. One more, or Jim?
Thanks, Jim. No? You just sell some books.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
Thank you.
One point, guys, is a good majority of the proceeds from the book do support the SEAL Family Foundation, so you're also supporting a worthy cause. We support the families of our active and fallen, so thank you.
And Gleason, thank you so much for bringing him here.
Thanks for having me, guys. I mean, literally having me.
Thank you so much for being with us, and again, if you're interested in the trip to Williamsburg, call Martha right away or grab me, because it will be sold out by the end of the afternoon. Keith Cargill, would you please stand so we can thank you for supporting us? And by the way, shameless plug, it was not set up. The Falks and the World Affairs Council bank at Texas Capital Bank, so thank you.